You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I want to thank so many people for staying for the last panel. I'm sure the reason you stayed is that you want to hear Francis Liang at the end. So it's not us. So thank you, Francis, for keeping people here. The three of us are going to talk about internal and external obstacles to Taiwan joining the TPP. So whatever the economic incentives may be, that we still have these obstacles, and it's important that we talk through them. I'm going to give a kind of general strategic picture, and then my colleagues are going to talk about whatever they want to talk about, but probably more from the domestic perspective. Now, as I think about Taiwan and TPP, it seems like a huge mountain with a sheer face near the top. And so the idea of climbing that for Taiwan seems very difficult. And part of the difficulty of the climb is domestic politics, and more ominously, there's the obstacle of China. So, you know, on first glance, it seems that getting to the peak seems pretty difficult or even impossible. But mountain climbers will tell you that success depends on finding the right path to the top. Rather than look for a path that goes straight up, that's the last thing you want to do, but you want to take advantage of topography and you want to avoid the most serious obstacles. In order to avoid dead ends and setbacks, you have to chart your path in the right stages. It's probably still going to be a hard climb, but it's not so insurmountable. So what I'm going to talk about are the stages of a possible path for Taiwan to the top of the TPP mountain. And I've identified what I think are the different steps that Taiwan might take to improve its chances. China's potential political opposition is one of these, but it's not the only one. But if the steps occur, and if they occur in the proper order, the odds of Taiwan's membership become less daunting. I'm just going to state some of these steps because we have talked about them, or we will talk about them. Step one is that the 12 countries that are party to the current TPP negotiations must complete an agreement. I mean, that's obvious. If they don't complete an agreement, then the opportunities for other countries joining it just become suspended. I'm hopeful that they will succeed. I think they're working very hard, but the final stages of any negotiation are the most difficult. Step two. Taiwan society must reach a broad political consensus on why TPP membership is vital to Taiwan's long-term economic competitiveness, prosperity, and welfare. I think Vincent earlier this afternoon spoke to that in an eloquent way. I think the Taiwan leadership, both political and corporate, understands this very clearly. In terms of the broader society, some parts of it are not yet convinced. And my colleagues will speak to that, I'm not going to. Third, Taiwan can and should restore its credibility as a negotiator with key trading partners. What do I mean by this? I think that doubts have arisen in the United States and perhaps among other trading partners that even if Taiwan's trade negotiators make difficult concessions in order to get an agreement, they can't always get those agreements ratified within Taiwan's political system. Now, this is not a uniquely Taiwan problem. It is a lot easier for the United States to negotiate trade agreements if we have something called Trade Promotion Authority, which means that it's just an up or down vote in our Congress. And right now we don't have Trade Promotion Authority, so you would forgive some of our TPP negotiating partners for having a question in their mind about whether they're making their concessions at the right time. The reason that these doubts arose have to do a lot with the beef issue, but not just because of that. This is not to question the sincerity of Taiwan's trade negotiators. It's more to point to the difficulties in the relationship between the executive yuan and the legislative yuan. I think this is a real issue. Vincent gave good answers to some of these questions in his talk. I don't think all the doubts in the United States have been removed. But the more that Taiwan can do from now moving forward to demonstrate that it can negotiate good agreements, it can get them ratified, then those doubts start to decline. So Taiwan's FTAs with other countries is important and getting them ratified. For example, the trade and services agreement through the legislature is important, and doing it in spite of the political obstacles. Fourth, Taiwan should and probably is developing a negotiating position and strategy for TPP. I'm sure that Taiwan's economic policymakers are already working on an inventory of how each of the TPP standards affects Taiwan, the regulatory policies and practices that would be affected, how relevant domestic interests are might be disadvantaged, and what has to be done between the gap of the current reality and TPP's expectations. And I think that Taiwan, by studying its own and other trade negotiations, including the current TPP negotiations, it can prepare itself for the TPP talks when they become available. And now we come to China and the challenge that China might pose to Taiwan's entry. And for this, I go back to the U.S. strategy in facilitating the accession of both Taiwan and the PRC to the WTO. I was chairman of AIT at the time, and the United States made a conscious decision to accelerate Taiwan's accession to the WTO, on the one hand because it was the right thing to do, but also because it would provide some encouragement to China to accelerate its own negotiations, because for political reasons, China would be afraid of Taiwan getting in first, and that gave it an incentive to move forward itself. Now, obviously, if China did not see a value in WTO for its own sake for China, it would not have been willing to do this. But it did see a value. And it didn't want to be excluded from the circle of WTO countries. It wanted to use WTO, or leaders like Zhu Rongji wanted to use WTO as leverage for carrying out domestic reform, and then there was the Taiwan matter as well. So I hope I'm right, that the incentives and disincentives facing China now are aligning in ways that replicate the late 1990s WTO pattern. First of all, TPP, if it is successful, will create the prospect of a significant circle of liberalization that China will be hard-pressed to ignore. The countries that are now negotiating TPP account for 37.8% of global output, 25.3% of global trade. This means United States and Japan, among others. TPP is successful, I think it would be fairly easy for the Republic of Korea to come, and that just expands the circle anymore. Second, objectively, China needs the reforms that TPP can offer, and the very factors that are becoming a drag on China's growth are the ones that TPP is designed to remove. So this leads me to step five. and that China's leaders must decide that significant economic reform is necessary. And we don't know how far they will go along that road. I actually think that the results of the third plenum are rather encouraging in that regard. This is an ambitious agenda, and it holds out the promise of a convergence between China's own priorities and the architecture that TPP creates. I mean, one question is whether China today has leaders of the vision and caliber of Zhu Rongji, but let's hope they do. And then, as in the late 1990s, there's the prospect of Taiwan's joining TPP. Now, obviously, this depends a lot on the United States being willing and firm to treat Taiwan's TPP membership on its own, on its economic merits. And letting China believe that we would actually go ahead. I think we should do that because, you know, if Taiwan meets the standards, despite the fact that it requires a lot of concessions and sacrifices, and if it's able to push this through the political system, even though it complicates the life of a number of economic sectors, we should be prepared to go ahead. So this is the path to the top of the mountain. It may be a little naive, but we've done it once before. It should give Taiwan confidence that we could do it again. And if you don't know that you can get to the top of the mountain, you're not going to start walking through the foothills. But, you know, perhaps Taiwan can get to the top of the mountain, and so it's good to start the work that's already begun. Thank you. Now I'm going to turn to Dave Brown. Dave is known to many of you. He was a Foreign Service officer for over 30 years. He taught for many years across the street at Zeiss, and he is on the board of a venerable institution, the American Institute in Taiwan. Dave?
Thank you, Richard, and thanks to Brookings for giving me the opportunity to appear on this panel. It was partly by my own choice and partly by the structure of this panel that I have been asked to talk about the domestic obstacles within Taiwan to trade liberalization and eventually Taiwan's joining the TPP. Talking about obstacles is not a particularly pleasant task to undertake, and so I'm going to, with Richard's encouragement, also say a few words at the end as to how these obstacles can be overcome to try and put a slightly more positive spin on things. Taiwan presents a paradox. On the one hand, it is a trade and export-oriented economy, and it has a number of companies that are extraordinarily successful and competitive internationally. They have a business leadership which was at lunch today, which represents all of those positive traits in Taiwan society. But on the other hand, it has a public which has a rather strong protectionist trend to it, to protectionist slant. In talking about this, and it's from the public that these obstacles to trade liberalization come. And so in talking about the obstacles, I'm going to talk about four things: public opinion, the role of the legislature, the role of the DPP opposition party, and the role of the governing party. To start with public opinion, roughly 60% of the general public in Taiwan sees imports as a threat to the economy and believes that limiting imports is important to protecting domestic jobs. These attitudes have been exacerbated, I think, over the past decade by the fact that real wages in Taiwan have not gone up in real terms, and the gap between the well-to-do and the less well-off has been exaggerated. Globalization, i.e. trade, is part of this, and it is those who have not done so well that are the people who voice the protectionist sentiments. If you look at those people in Taiwan who think the economy is not done well, roughly two-thirds of them are protectionist in their outlook. If you divide the Taiwan population into five 20% groups, from the wealthy to the less well-off, it's the lowest 20% in terms of income who are the strongest opponents, and it's only the top 20% that has even a slim majority of the general public who's in favor of further trade liberalization. Now, for the role of the LY, Taiwan's a democracy, a vibrant democracy, and it's perfectly reasonable for the legislative yuan to reflect public sentiment to a degree. And this comes about in one respect because as a vibrant democracy, Taiwan has many civil society groups, trade associations, labor unions, farmers groups, special interest groups, even wealthy individuals who have particular sectoral concerns. And all of these groups get involved in Taiwan politics and support campaigns for the legislature. And as a result of this, there are some members of the legislature who are, in effect, surrogate spokesmen for these domestic constituencies. And they are the ones who voice some of the concerns about trade liberalization. Another thing has to do with the way the legislature makes decisions. Much of the business of the legislative yuan is not done in plenary session, but through a process of inter-party consultation in which each party, regardless of its size, has an equal voice. And this process means that the voices of the smaller parties, including the DPP, the largest of those, has an out, its weight is overweighted, and that the majority that the KMT holds in the legislature doesn't always really dictate the way things come out. So the structure of the legislature complicates trade liberalization. Turning to the DPP, the leaders, or at least many of the leaders of the DPP, are sophisticated, internationally minded individuals who understand the rationale for Taiwan liberalizing its economy further, joining the TPP, endorsing free trade agreements, and so forth. But they have a membership, their voting supporters, who are the most protectionist group within Taiwan society. Roughly 70% of people who identify as DPP supporters have a sort of protectionist tinge to their views on these trade issues. And so it's understandable that the DPP is going to, in many cases, reflect their interests as the largest opposition party. But it's also true that the DPP uses any issue that appeals to its members as a vehicle for trade or for political mobilization and often puts the interests of their partisan interests ahead of their policy views. And that affects the way business is done in the legislature. Turning to the governing party, KMT is the party of business. I would guess that most of the members who are here today would be supporters of the KMT. They have, therefore, a strong understanding of the role of trade liberalization and how joining the TPP can help preserve Taiwan's, improve Taiwan's international competitiveness. President Ma Ying-jeou is a perfect example of this. He is a bold spokesman for free trade, and on the beef issue, after a great deal of hesitation, he made the right decisions and pushed that through to a successful resolution. But the The governing party has its problems as well, and one of them has to do with coordination between the executive and the KMT caucus in the legislative yuan. The KMT caucus wants to ensure that its members' points of view are taken into account, and looking from the outside, perhaps I'm wrong, it doesn't seem as though the coordination between the caucus and the executive branch has always been done as well as it might be done. Beyond that, there is a friction between President Ma and Speaker Wong in the legislative yuan, which has had a deleterious effect on the ability of the executive and the caucus in the LY to coordinate, most symbolized by the recent move by President Ma to deprive Speaker Wong of his membership in the KMT, and as a result of that, perhaps losing his role as Speaker. So the KMT is also part of the obstacles to getting trade liberalization accomplished. So to summarize it, I think there are a number of obstacles that stand in the way of trade liberalization generally and TPP membership in particular. Now, how can we overcome these? Vincent Chao has one point of view, and that is that these obstacles are, these differences internally are exaggerated by some people, and that he has a strong confidence that the differences, that there's a considerable degree of consensus between the ruling and opposition party on these, and that in the end that will determine it. I would like to believe that he is correct, but it seems to me that domestic political factors are always intractable. They certainly are in the United States, and they appear to be in Taiwan as well. So how can we make progress? I'll have throw out four quick ideas. One is that it cannot be left to the KMT and the business community alone to argue the case for TPP membership. The opposition party in particular, the DPP, needs to step up to the plate and become part of the voice within Taiwan arguing the case for further trade liberalization, even though this may not be acceptable to some of their own members. Secondly, I think, and here again I may be overly critical of the government when one of their distinguished representatives is in the audience, but I think that as an outside observer, that there is more the government could do to explain the course of negotiations while they are being conducted to the public and to the affected sectors in Taiwan, so that when the agreement is announced, they have built up a certain body of understanding and consensus on the importance of acting positively on the agreement. And I, for one, perceive that the government has not been doing that work as thoroughly as it might be. Thirdly, the KMT needs to work out a deal between the executive and Speaker Wong on how to move the KMT's legislative priorities through the LY in a more efficient manner. Now, when I wrote that sentence a week ago, I said people in the audience are going to laugh. There's no way that this is going to happen. But in fact, Ma and Speaker Wong have shaken hands, and they have agreed that government business should go on. And just yesterday, President Ma, in his role as chairman of the party, instructed the party to form a task force which would find a way to resolve these differences concerning Wong's membership in the party. So I have some hope that the KMT will be able to do this. And thirdly, turning to the DPP, I think the DPP needs on certain important issues to put policy ahead of partisanship. And in this respect, I am somewhat encouraged by the statement that the DPP put out last week with respect to the Singapore, the Taiwan-Singapore Economic Cooperation Agreement, endorsing that agreement as something that was positive. And on this point, I would agree with Vincent that its way seems to be cleared for smooth passage through the legislature. So those are my four domestic bits of suggestion. On the international scene, I think I would take Vincent's comment, or the theme of his speech, is the most important thing that we in the United States can do, which is to do everything we can to get Taiwan into the TPP negotiating process, because it's that process which is going to drive liberalization in Taiwan. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. We now turn to our third speaker, Philip Yang. Philip is one of Taiwan's most prominent political scientists. He was trained at UVA, which speaks well of him. He has taught at National Taiwan University, published extensively, and created a good platform for discussions of Taiwan's security. In good Confucian fashion, he hasn't stayed within the walls of the university, but done important stints in government service. He was minister of the Government Information Office, and he was deputy secretary general in the National Security Council. So, Philip, welcome.
Thank you, Richard. It's always nice to come back, because just like Richard, kind introduction that I went to UVA, which is only, if you drive a little bit faster, 1.5 hours, but normally it should take 2.5. I didn't get a speed ticket. But I really enjoy staying here in Washington, even though when I went to UVA, I was supported by a Fulbright scholarship, but with only a partial grant, so I'm not Fulbright. I'm only half right. Let me begin with two major things that I think that in the I think before the end of 2016, in the coming 3 years, I think that the two major things will have a tremendous impact on Taiwan. I mean, internally or externally. Of course, one would be, the first one would be the 2016 presidential election. It's, of course, it's related to the development of democratic consolidation in Taiwanese politics, and also relates to the future development of the cross-strait relations. Okay, I think you know the background very well, and also we'll definitely touch upon about the identity politics inside Taiwan, okay, which our Vice President Vincent Hsiao mentioned. And so I'm not going to, you know, discuss these issues, because we're here to discuss TPP. So that will be the second thing. Whether we can participate in the TPP negotiation process in the upcoming 3 years, I think that would be a major, major challenge for Taiwan. I think that, the reason is clear, but what's the meaning for TPP for Taiwan? I think that economics probably will tell you that it's about the economic diversity or integration with the regional economic development, and which has been going on for decades. And then balance the external economic relationship, which Vice President Hsiao mentioned, that to ensure that freedom of external choices, I mean, both economically and strategic sense. And then, of course, that will be the major topic for today's discussion. The four possible implications of joining the TPP would be the political, security, strategic, and psychological, you know, implications. I think that for economic diversity, it's clear that for Taiwan, 70% of our GDP actually depends on, related to the trade with other countries. And ECFA, Singapore, and New Zealand represent a major step for Taiwan's efforts to try to secure our major export markets. The number one trade partner since 2003, mainland China, and then two major trade partner with Taiwan. I think that, but that's not enough. If you compare, the list of what the Korean government have done in the past, okay, and not to mention some other ASEAN countries. So, and we know the reason behind this. Richard mentioned this, mainland China's opposition and some of the political reality. And of course, the domestic problem, which David addressed, and I will touch upon a little bit later. But indeed, to ensure the economic diversity, I think it's vital for Taiwan. And integration with the regional economic development, I think it was in 1993, and when the United States first held the Economic Leaders Summit in APAC, then Defense Minister, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's William Perry, he has a proposal that why don't we change the APAC, the C of the APAC? APAC stands for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. It doesn't really sound like a name for any organization, but he argued that why don't we change the name cooperation into Asia-Pacific Economic Community, you know, following the model then the EEC to EC Economic Community in Europe. That was the idea then. Of course, rejected by all ASEAN countries and even Japan, okay, because it was impossible by then that to have this kind of what they call the Western legalistic pact of free trade agreement. Okay, if you look at today, what is the process? Those eight ASEAN plus agreements, and then now China, Korea, and Japan are having summit discussing a possible the Northeast Asia free trade zone. And then now we can see the development of TPP and RCEP. So eventually, I think it was a couple of years ago mentioned in APAC again, that hopefully there will be an Asia-Pacific free trade agreement in the future. So that was this is the train, as a matter of fact. And Taiwan, because of the our ambassador here to the WTO, Ambassador Ling's here, because after 2004, that problem with the WTO and countries decided to sign bilateral and multilateral trade agreements, FTA, to secure trade relations with other countries and market shares. But Taiwan, because of a lot of problems, now excluded from those 40-some trade agreements in Asia. And finally, we secure one with Singapore and New Zealand. So this is far from enough. And as Vice Minister mentioned that we found this quite interesting, the SBC's research about this economic linkage between the development of a GDP and export of Taiwan, that if you, let me just rephrase that, before 2008, if there 1% of the increase of U.S. GDP, there would be, which can bring about 6% of export in Taiwan. But not anymore after 2008. On the contrary, if there's a 1% of increase in mainland China's GDP, there would be a 3.8% of increase of export of Taiwan. So you can see this kind of a trend. Because of all because of the cluster economic enhancement. So let me touch upon a little bit on this political and security and strategic and psychological implication. I think that this morning we visit the House. I think the chairman of the Asia-Pacific Committee, Steve Schaubel, he said that. I think it's very, very strong and quite accurate. He said that, let me quote, the best defense or deterrence for Taiwan is for the PRC to know and to believe that Taiwan is strong and United States supports Taiwan. Okay, if we look at what he said in the past, mostly probably mainly from political, military, security angle, and that the United States under the 1979 TRA to support Taiwan and give Taiwan sufficient military defense capability, like those Apaches we recently acquired. That's probably, and then we probably stop there, okay, thinking about that Taiwan is strong and to deter that mainland China's possible invasion with the support and linkage with U.S. Military. But in fact, actually, I think that my experiences in the past couple of days together with this delegation remind me that I think it's basically it's the economic strength that serves as the backbone of maintaining the strength of Taiwan. And interests between United States and Taiwan, especially U.S. interests. We mentioned so many times about U.S. interests in Asia or in Taiwan. I think that would be, of course, a political institution, a liberal political institution or human rights. But I think most important of all still economic interests and peaceful status quo. And, of course, recently freedom of navigation. That would be mainly the U.S. interest in Asia. So I think this is quite important for Taiwan to join the TPP and other trade agreement to secure our economic diversity, integration with the regional economic development, and most important of all, that our relations and economic linkage with not only the United States, but also other countries like Japan and the rest of the members of TPP. And there's a lot of debate about what is the essence or meaning of U.S. Rebalancing policy. I think that they mentioned the five or seven elements in the official document. But from my point of view, it's that major three angles. One, of course, would be the economic one, the U.S. of policy of re-engaging Asia-Pacific economic economies. And then TPP now, of course, serves as a pillar of this major U.S. economic rebalancing policy. Another one would be, of course, the military part and the enhancement of its military relations and linkages with major allies and this is a very important part for the United States. Of course, the apparent one would be, the third one would be the diplomatic or multilateral efforts done by the United States, even joined the East Asia Summit, which is probably unthinkable a couple of years ago. So rebalancing means that U.S. interest pays a great attention in its interest in this region. So I think that from this angle, we have to look at that how Taiwan can fit in this kind of a framework and development. And so I think that U.S. interest in Asia and Taiwan, and to understand that the Taiwan's participation in TPP, not just for our own economic development and liberalization, but also for to finding our positions and to secure our relations with some major country in this region. Well, then let me turn to some of the domestic obstacles that I would like, if I may, to add to the list of that David provided. I think that there's a very interesting coincidence, if I may, because as I mentioned, that WTO faced this problem after 2004-05, and then countries that decided to go for this FTA efforts. And at that time, our government, the TPP government, actually didn't respond that promptly, and also facing a lot of difficulty and because of the political reality across the Taiwan Strait. But ever since 2008, so the Ma government decided to ease the cross-strait economic constraints and engage in economic dialogue and signing altogether now 19 agreements with the mainland China. And some of them actually not that economic in nature. For instance, like the judicial assistance and combat and crime combating, okay? But, however, this is together with our effort to try to join the war and the region and the war for economic liberalization and deregulation. So it's this two trains actually tangled together, and as Vice President Hsiao mentioned, that If I may add to your explanation to the domestic resistance to the economic liberalization and deregulation is that it's also part of the identity politics and cross-strait distrust. Okay, and in this process, of course, we signed the ECFA in 2010, and then now the surface part package is still waiting for approval in the legislative yuan. So from DPP or from some of the protectionist minded individuals or in elites, that this is not just about trade, this is not just about liberalization, and this is also about, you know, identity, this is also about ideology. So it's getting more really complex. And together with that is that the differences between KMT and DPP, and then you're right in mentioning that some problem inside the process of procedure of the LY and the legislative yuan and efforts that should be done more by both parties, especially the DPP, to seek bipartisan consensus in terms of both the cross-strait economic relations, proper cross-strait economic policies, and regional policy for further trade liberalization. And another element I would like to add is that you mentioned that I think is Richard mentioned that now political and corporate elites and leaders have no difficulty for supporting this trade liberalizations. But now in Taiwan, there is a train, what we call the 人民运动. How to translate that?
People's movement?
Yeah, thank you. So it's getting, with the support of our media, anyone been to Taiwan, you know, influence of media. And currently I would say that some of our media are holding a quite negative position toward trade liberalization and deregulation. You can I blame them? I have to say that, because just like David mentioned that, because in the past 15 or 20 years or so, Taiwan maintained this kind of economic stagnation, okay? And there's literally no increase of real sense of wages or salary. So this is very difficult for the people, and it tangled with cross-strait and identity and ideology. However, as I mentioned again, if you have time to go back to Vice President Xiao's remarks, he mentioned that then let's look at the way we signed the ECFA, and then and also pact with the Singapore and New Zealand, and then the way we solved this U.S. beef issue. Okay, the U.S. beef issue was there for 6 years. During that 6 years of time, North Korea signs probably more than 20 FTA, including the one with the United States. So that's that cause of distrust on the U.S. side, especially probably on the USTR side. And it's understandable. So, but I would like to explain this, that it's not just a simple, not like in other countries, simple just a resistance from the protectionist-minded people of rejecting this trend of trade liberalization and deregulation, and especially looking at what it means for Taiwan, especially in the past and in the future. So I think that it's indeed our responsibility, our own responsibility to deal with this. Like, I totally agree with David's suggestion and Richard's argument that we have to deal with this, and political elites and social people interested in the people's movements and media should take a serious look and examination of how it means, what it means for us in participating in the PPP negotiation. Because again, when I let me back to the argument I made, I think that in the coming 3 years, not just the 2006 presidential elections, Taiwanese are paying too much attention to those elections, and but fail to pay equal attention to those real thing. One would be our participation of the TPP negotiation. So I thank you.
Thank you very much. Really excellent. We have now 15 minutes for questions and answers, and maybe I'll take a couple at a time, and please identify yourself, and if you want to direct your question to any particular person, please say so. So I saw my colleague Maria's hand first, so we'll give her the first question.
Thank you very much. Mireya Solis, senior fellow here at Brookings. I have two brief questions. I think it was remarkable in the keynote this afternoon that Mr. Chow asked, does the United States really care about the U.S.-Taiwan relationship? And given that Taiwan is extremely dependent on China and marginalized from everybody else would be against the interest of the United States, is the United States prepared to walk the walk in facilitating TPP membership? So I guess my question is to ask you those questions to you, the panelists, and what is your assessment in terms of key figures in the Obama administration and congressional leaders and USTR and so forth? How much are they thinking about Taiwan's potential membership in the TPP? How much of a priority it is? Where is the discussion at this moment? And the second question I have is regarding the potential WTO model of accession where both Taiwan and China came in close succession. And I think that we have to think about how ready are these countries to join TPP. And even though the third plenum was very encouraging, it seems to me that China is still a long way off in terms of being ready, whereas despite the domestic obstacles that you discussed this afternoon, Taiwan could be readier sooner. So what happens if Taiwan is much ready much sooner than China in terms of seeking TPP membership? How would that affect the conversation? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we'll take a question here and then do some answers.
Thank you. I'm Jerry Chen, graduate student at Maxwell Syracuse University. I have two-part questions. The first is, will Taiwan's entry to the TPP significantly affect cross-strait relations and existing trade agreements such as ECFA or the service agreements? And my second part is, as the past speakers on the panel says that Taiwan's economy is essential for its survival, is TPP a method of Taiwan to increase, expand its soft power in the Asia-Pacific region to ensure security stability instead of using the past hard approach, which is using military strategy of increasing arms deals with the U.S.? Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to offer an initial answer?
Well,
Okay. To Maria's question, I suspect that there are probably different points of view or different emphases within the administration. I think that in USTR and some places in Capitol Hill, the problem of credibility of commitments is more serious than in other places. That's in part because they reflect the interests of sectors in the United States that would like to expand exports to Taiwan, and so maybe they're setting a somewhat higher standard. I think in more political parts of the administration and within among the scholarly community, there may be an understanding that cross-strait relations are more likely to go well if Taiwan has sources of strength that itself builds up. And economic competitiveness is one of them, and that depends on having strong economic relations with all major trading partners, not just with China, and that the United States can help in that regard, not by lowering standards to TPP, but being open to Taiwan, and as Dave said, facilitate Taiwan's entry into the negotiating process, which will then have knock-off effects. So. We had TPP and cross-strait relations and TPP and soft power. Okay. Okay, please.
I like the term soft power because I was a minister for GIO that all the media, movies and music is actually under my domain. And it's indeed that if we can join the TPP, it's not just that for the sake of political, you know, linkages or to try to avoid of international isolation. I think it's mainly for economic liberalization and also economic competitiveness in the future for Taiwan's economy, and have a linkage with, of course, with the development of the soft power, and that's the reason why I argue that Taiwan's efforts, Taiwan's before the TPP negotiation, and including that the composition of this delegation coming to the States from New York to Washington and San Francisco with so many top business leaders. If you know Taiwan, you know those are big names, you know. It's, in fact, from my personal opinion, okay, again, my personal opinion, because I also serve as a spokesperson for this delegation, my personal opinion is that this is Taiwan's own rebalancing strategy, okay? And because of in the past, after 2008, with our start of trade liberalization, which is identical with our economic negotiation with the mainland China, so inevitably this is business means business, you know. And then any democratic society, government cannot restrain or ask those businessmen to do or not to do. So. This is a very natural development that China became our number one trade partner. And so, but government, let me use our vice minister point of view, that government have a plan for the long term, have a vision. So government cannot take, influence the short-term market force. But what is the mid-term or long-term vision for Taiwan's economy? I think that's the government's position and obligation. So indeed, we think that try to enhance our U.S.-Taiwan trade relations and also hoping that United States supports Taiwan's to join the TPP negotiation would be our own rebalancing strategy. So if I may to put it this way, to using your term.
Okay. Dave?
On the question of soft power, which is not, I would address that in this way. And I think Taiwan, as it tries to make its way in a difficult world environment, has two trump cards, you might say, to play. One is its democratic values, which was the start of Vincent's speech. And the other is its economic strength. And it's important as an economic partner for other countries. And if Taiwan is indeed, and I believe it is, being marginalized to a certain degree by its exclusion from the process of trade liberalization that's going on in East Asia, and its economy is not performing optimally, then I think TPP is a crucial opportunity for Taiwan to strengthen its economy and strengthen that pillar of its relationship with the rest of the world.
So let's take a couple more questions. See someone right there, right on the aisle. Gentlemen.
Yes, Chung Yen from National Change University. I have a small but important question about TPP in general to Richard. In your talks, you mentioned about the Trade Promotion Authority. If there were no authority, what would have happened? Thank you.
Okay, and the lady at the back.
Yes. Hi, it's Shirley Lim from Chinese University of Hong Kong. This question is first for Richard, and then the second one maybe for Mr. Brown and for Mr. Yang. But as we know, all of you have mentioned the services sector really needs restructuring and upgrading in Taiwan. And in this light, one of the key parts of the services sector is the financial sector. But we understand that the TPP discussion currently is not including the financial services sector, like the U.S. has been trying to exclude it from discussions with Europe. How do you think about it, Richard, in terms of the possibility of financial services being included? And in that light, turning to the domestic side for Mr. Brown and Mr. Yang, the Taiwanese elites and domestic society have both been very close-minded about opening the financial sector, and that needs to catch up to the manufacturing to support the Taishang in China. So how do you think about this in terms of joining TPP and, surprisingly, to go along with what Mr. Yang was saying, in terms of balancing the China part, because Taiwan is getting closer to China and financial integration?
On the first question, if TPA does not pass, then that creates the real possibility that when the trade agreements go before the House and the Senate, that they're open for amendment. And amendment simply means changing the text of the agreement. And, if it's a binding change in the text, then the agreement has to be renegotiated. So this is similar to what happened with the beef protocol that the United States negotiated with Taiwan in 2009, and the legislative yuan saw fit to change it. And we know what happened then. Shirley asked really formidable questions. Whether or not financial services is in TPP, the question is that right?
I don't know.
Is it? No. It is? Oh. Okay. Maria, do you want to? Could project, please.
I'm not an expert on financial sectors, but my understanding is that in the U.S.-EU negotiations, what has been the main issue is that you're talking about, from the European side, they're asking for convergence and mutual recognition of standards. All American FTAs have included financial services, but they deal with the non-discrimination aspect of it, and that's how I understand it's being discussed in the TPP, and that's why, with Europeans in particular, the financial services talks have been more sensitive.
My non-expert view would be that even if financial services is dealt with in a somewhat limited way in TPP, it's still in Taiwan's interest to liberalize. I mean, it's for its own sake to do it, not as a favor to the United States. Any other? Okay, Steve, please. Steve Chan, former Minister of Health.
It was a great, I'm glad I made a decision not to go to Senate, but sit here. Let's do this, first of all. Well, I want to take this opportunity to clear some point Vice President Shao said it previously.
Okay.
One of the audience asked him, is this your personal opinion or government's decision? He said, no, this is mine. But what he really means is, I'm not in government now. I cannot speak as a government official. That's what he really means. But as far as I know, this to join the TPP is the current administration's policy. And the last year, President Ma's inauguration speech made that clear in the speech. He said, we want to be member of the TPP within 8 years. So that's clear. I just want to take this to express that. The other thing is these two sessions talk about the economy first, politics this. That's a perfect setting for that. Actually, this is two elements always in it. On the previous session, talk about the, I think Terry Koh, he said many Americans doesn't realize the value of ECFA and didn't take advantage of it, which is I am fully agree with that. Not many American companies knows that. Until recently, some of them, particularly, I'm familiar with the pharmaceutical company. And 10 years ago, they see the huge market in China. They kind of forget Taiwan. They move their headquarters to Beijing and then just leave a small teams in Taiwan. So they said that's a bit, well, yes, they get the initial success. But now they're stuck, and they regret. Some of them, the many of them tells me about this now. So until I tell them, well, we have ECFA, they say, wow, I wish we know that then. We knew that. Then if that's the case, they don't have to stuck there. They can just take in the ECFA and then sail through it. Well, that's what I'm just saying. But now they know, and I hope the people will take this opportunity. And the third, I'm very glad David talked about the this internal Taiwan domestic politics about this difficulty. You know very well what happened in Taiwan. You talk about the from DPP side, yes, that's what the situation. You talk about the KMT side, yes, that's the situation. But some people ask me about is TPP is the American strategy to quarantine or constrain the China, which I'm not so sure, but I believe this is, as far as I know, TPP is the free trade, and we set up the standard. As long as you meet the standard, you join. And why China goes to RCEP, my personal opinion is they know they can't get there right now. So they want to lower the standard and make another organization as their private club. And then, but when the time comes, when they are ready, they will move into TPP. So there's no need to use that kind of thinking to think about it. And particularly, recently we visited China 3 weeks ago with Vincent. And we also went to Shanghai. And then to really know what's going on with their free trade zone, that means. And they really try. I know they are trying, but they are afraid of trying. So that's why they took Shanghai as a pilot plan to see how they can open up, and particularly from the financial control area. So I think they know eventually they need to go to that stage, but they take their steps. So with that understanding, I think TPP should just go ahead, and that will help them move along. Last week, the Sanzhong Chenhui, they take their step. You can see the result from Sanzhong Chenhui. That's what they try to do. So what is the best possibility of Taiwan can overcome all of this domestic politics and really get ready for this? I personally think as long as we work for that, a time will come. But be realistic, I personally think this probably, the nearest possibility to get this come to the real consensus has to be after 2016. And by that time, I think we'll have a more consensus by then. And on the last, I have a very strong feeling about what happened now with this kind of imbalance, and so much depends on the Chinese market from Taiwan's point of view. I don't think Taiwan purposely chose that. It was just they became that, and because the economical situation, but also in American policy that times, Taiwan's businessman needs to survive, and they find that's the way to survive, so they move over there. That's all. There's no political intention to do that, but it just happened that way. But okay, now we know this is the situation now. American try to rebalance Asia now. So we got to think about this. Can this situation continues to just allow that business as business? I don't think so. If business as business, we conduct business with business way only, then they will continue this kind of trend. If United States try to rebalance Asia, Taiwan tried to rebalance ourselves, then some policy has to move in and to redirect this direction. And this is something, I think, this message, we try to bring it to here. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'm glad that you chose to stay at Brookings and not go to the Senate. I think we need to bring this panel to a close. I want to thank Dave Brown and Philip Young for your great presentations. Thank you all for your questions. And so you are excused, and if I could ask Francis to come and join me on the stage. Okay. Okay, please. I think we should just go ahead. No, please. I'll just give you a brief introduction. For our last speaker, we're privileged to have someone who is an official of the ROC government, Francis Guo Xinyang. He's the Deputy Minister for Taiwan's Ministry of Economic Affairs. He has served Taiwan in the Taiwan government and served the Taiwan people for a long time in seeking to enhance Taiwan's prosperity and competitiveness, and we're pleased to have him conclude our session today with a few remarks. Francis?
Okay, thank you very much, Richard. First of all, I must say that I feel both honored and excited to have this opportunity to participate in today's program. I'm honored because we had many the presenters and the commentators that participate in today's program are renowned experts in this area. So I feel very much honored to be with them. I'm excited because I learned a lot from all the speakers and the presenters today on this important subject matter of Taiwan's Taiwan and the TPP and Taiwan's possible membership in the TPP framework. I believe this is a very, very important subject matter, so I'd like to share with you some of my thoughts and some of the conclusions I got from the previous discussions. Of course, as you understand, Taiwan's economic development is very much dependent on international trade. This has been explained time and again, and also by Professor Yang. Of course, we should not forget about a multilateral negotiation in Geneva, but we all know that international trade and investment has never been a barrier-free environment, and it's because the Doha round of negotiation in Geneva under WTO hasn't been able to come to a close after 11 years of negotiation. So now we see more and more bilateral and regional negotiation on free trade agreement. And this proliferation of regionalism has taken its toll on Taiwan very much because we calculated that currently for every $100 value of trade that Taiwan conducted, only $4 is eligible for preferential treatment under a form of FTA, while it's for Singapore it's $63, and for Korea it's $34. And but Korea is currently negotiating more FTAs, so this put Taiwan in a very disadvantageous position to conduct our foreign trade. As a matter of fact, the World Economic Forum, they did a study and they called that a global enabling trade index. And Taiwan always comes as one of the top performers, but only on this index, Taiwan ranked, I believe it's the 125th or 126th out of 130 countries surveyed. That's the duty we pay as in relation to the nominal tariff. But because we have only $4 out of 100 is under FTA. So we pay on average the highest import duty in all our major markets. And when I came to that figure, I was surprised that we would be 125th of 26th in the world because we won't be able to enjoy the FTA treatment in all our major markets. So this is a very, very important subject matter for us, and I will tell you how I think it is important. But, Richard, I'd like to mention one thing that you mentioned that probably in some U.S. trade officials' mind, Taiwan's credibility of negotiating and implementing trade agreement is at issue. And I fully understand if that impression comes from the trade on beef for 2 years. But to be honest, even for our beef protocol, probably only 2% of the whole protocol was stopped by our legislature. But in the meantime, U.S. government are working with us. We were negotiating ITA agreement under WTO in Geneva. We were actually United States, Taiwan, and Japan. We brought EU to WTO dispute settlement because we don't think that they are enforcing the ITA 1 faithfully, and we work with the USG very diligently. And we even were the one that started the negotiation on TISA, the Trade in Service Agreement in Geneva, working with the USTR. But unfortunately, those were the negotiators for IT products. Mm-hmm. They are not for beef. So different people have different portfolio. So but they give people the impression that the credibility of Taiwan's trade negotiation is under scrutiny. But we actually are very happy that we, in the meantime, are still working with our U.S. counterparts on many of the regional and multilateral negotiation. And, of course, TPP is important for us, but why? I think I will give you two more reasons that I think it's important. One is that TPP is, by all accounts, the most valuable undertaking for Taiwan because it's a high standard. As President Hsiao mentioned, if we can finish this negotiation, then probably we can go out to do all other negotiations on its economic merits. Number two, TPP membership includes some of Taiwan's most important trading partners, particularly the United States and Japan. Mm-hmm. Japan is our number two largest trading partner. United States is number three. So we have ECFA with China, our biggest market, and joining TPP would take care of almost all our major trading partners except for Europe. Mm-hmm. So this is very, very important in a way that can, instead of individually looking for bilateral negotiation with Canada, with the United States, with Japan, this will be a perfect arena for us to finish the rest of our FTA strategy. So we think this is very important. And I think previous speakers mentioned that not many American firms realize the value of Taiwan to their business because in the past 5 years under President Ma, Taiwan has repositioned ourselves tremendously as the gateway in the region. For instance, personally, I helped six Japanese firms to open their operation in Taiwan. One larger one is the Japanese digital camera manufacturer Canon. In the year 2010, we signed EGFA with China. In the same year, they started building two new factories in Taiwan. Each employed 2,500 to 3,000 workers. Why? Because under EGFA early harvest, digital camera is duty-free to China. Digital camera components are free to China. So they built one factory for the camera, one factory for the components. And they started the shipping 1 year afterwards. And they were happy with the factory, so actually they are now shipping to Europe from this factory. And because Japanese business realized that for Japanese government to negotiate and conclude an FTA with China probably will take quite a few years. So we hope that the U.S. business can come to the same conclusion and realizing that partnering with Taiwanese business will help them to go into that market tremendously. And I want also to mention, to answer the question people ask, are we prepared or are we ready for TPP negotiation? I think we heard all the comments. I read the report from your institution. I really am impressed by the depth and width of those observations and the suggestions. Mm-hmm. Some we are currently doing in Taiwan already. For instance, you mentioned the interest groups in your study, and we are creating special task force in direct dialogue with those interest group, and actually we also we have an internal task force for negotiating FTAs. It was chaired by our premier, mm-hmm. and last year we also created a special committee under this task force committee for industrial advisory work, and that is the outreach and the dialogue with industry and academias. And I also like to really draw your attention to the fact that we started negotiating with Singapore 2010, right after we signed EGFA with China. And then 2011, we started the negotiation with New Zealand on FTA. And this past July, we signed FTA with New Zealand. And on the 7th of November, we signed our FTA with Singapore. The reason why I would like to mention those two FTAs is not only that by opening the door with China, we are also opening the door to other trading partners. But in the process of negotiating with those two trading partners, they teach us a lot about TPP preparation because they are, on one hand, currently negotiating with the other partners, including United States on TPP. So when they negotiate a bilateral trade with us, they remind us very much that they are using the TPP standard to request Taiwan, because they, first of all, they don't want to maintain two different trade systems. That would be very costly for the trade community. But they also want to be sure that they are negotiating at a high standard. So actually, when we changed the law, trade law, to accommodate New Zealand's request for certificate of origin in the future to be issued by exporters themselves, they're self-certifying. Mm-hmm. Our law didn't allow that. So we changed the law because we know that many TPP countries are currently doing that. Mm-hmm. So we have TPP in mind while we were negotiating with New Zealand and Singapore. So actually, some of the American negotiators later, when they had the opportunity to see the full text of our FTA with New Zealand and now with Singapore, they really love saying, hey, those guys are talking with you on TPP content. So this is the way we prepare ourselves. And we also prepare ourselves by benchmarking the liberalization commitments from, say, CORUS, the U.S. trade deal with Korea. So we set up an internal interagency task force. We review the commitment and the regulatory change in, say, Korean-U.S. deal and ask our agency, can you come up with the same commitment? If not, why not? So we are doing this one by one, putting our own agency at spot. But they understand we are serious about this. This is how we prepare ourselves. So, again, I think this is a very, very interesting workshop, and I learned a lot. And I would like to, again, using this opportunity to affirm two things. One is that I have the confidence to share with all of you that Taiwan is ready to apply for TPP membership when a window of opportunity becomes available. And number two, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you, Richard, and the Brookings Institution for organizing this important workshop. And this definitely cleared many issues for the road for Taiwan to join TPP in the future. Again, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Francis. I think you made some very valuable contributions to our discussion. As you suggested at the end, this is part of an educational process. As we've discussed through the afternoon, this TPP is partly a policy challenge, but it's also a political challenge. So there's a lot of education that goes on within Taiwan, and you're responsible for a lot of the educating. We should call you professor instead of deputy minister. There's a lot of education that has to go on in the United States to clear up misunderstandings. And then between us, there's a lot. So we're pleased to be a part of that. And thank you for your involvement. I want to thank my colleague Joshua for the opportunity to work together with him. And I want to thank the staff for preparing and executing a really fine event. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.